We interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin. From the International News Service, the war ends. A special bulletin, I repeat, from the International News Service, the war ends.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. The United Nations, on land, on the sea, in the air, and to the four corners of the earth, are united and are victorious.
As I look above me, I see that the ticker tape is flying out of the windows. People are celebrating in the offices high above Euclid Avenue here at Playhouse Square, and everybody is just as happy can be. Let's move over this way.
50 years ago, two words, war ends, thrilled Americans as no others could. For soldiers, these words meant they would soon be home. For civilians, they meant work would ease and life could go on. More than 16 million Americans served in World War II. Over 400,000 died. But the end of the war that witnessed the Holocaust and the atomic bomb did not mean a return to normal. The nation and its states had been transformed. This hour, we'll look at what the end of the war meant in Illinois. We'll hear from veterans, workers, farmers, and families about how their lives changed when peace came to the prairie. The war ended in stages. June 6, 1944, D-Day. The Allies invade Normandy. May 8, 1945. Germany surrenders unconditionally, and President Truman declares victory in Europe. August 6, 1945. The atomic bomb is dropped on Hiroshima, Japan. August 9, 1945. A second atomic bomb is dropped on Nagasaki. August 14, 1945. President Truman announces Japan's surrender. September 2, 1945. The surrender is signed on the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. They were emotional months for soldiers overseas and for people at home.
This is VE Day at the University of Illinois. We and our allies are now faced with a colossal task in the attempt to restore some semblance of law and order in most of the ravaged countries of Europe. Unless this can be done, no durable peace can be achieved. And the men and women of the 46 nations now assembled at San Francisco will have met in vain.
My name is Ruby Simpson, and I lived in Jacksonville, Illinois at the end of the World War II. And at the day that the announcement came, being a very young girl, I was in Nicholas Park swimming pool. And the lifeguard with his big bullhorn blew his whistle, and he wasn't yelling for anyone to get out of the water. He was telling us the war was over. There was a lot of splish-splashing going around. That evening we had street dancing around the square in Jacksonville, and just the regular hurrah that our family and friends was coming home.
My name is Bernhard Rosenquist. One of the guys had gotten word on it and come running into barracks screaming it was over, it's over. None of us knew what he was talking about at first. Then he explained that he just heard it on the radio and that the war had ended. And boy, that barracks went apart and nothing flat.
I'm Charles Green. I live at 805 South 3rd Street, Hubston. I was just getting off work the way I remember. And I come home and sit down on the front porch here, and lady across the street from us, she says, "What's happening?" And I said, "The war's over." She went right up to church. She was a good woman. She had to go up and pray a little bit again. Very good woman.
This is Paul Sheddenhelm, Champaign. I'll tell you one home guy I remember. We're in Chicago. I came into Chicago, and my wife met me there, and we were walking down the loop, and our favorite performer was on Latin. Oh, my God, here it is. And Ted Lewis and his band, Me and My Shadow. Boy, I'll tell you, Chicago people You couldn't have treated servicemen any better than Chicago people did. Absolutely marvelous. And we were there, and we stayed two or three shows. They said, stay as long as you want.
The man up in the moon and me. You know what I do?
My name is Charles Cassad. For the surrender, I was over in Tokyo Bay. We were just 300 yards off the battleship Missouri. I happened to be on guard duty that particular day, and everybody was taking turns looking through the binoculars, watching General MacArthur and all them there signing the peace treaty.
Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
The victory in 1945 came in part through the efforts of nearly 1 million men and women from Illinois who served in World War II. 18,850 of those Illinoisans died in the war.
People seemed to be happy that the war was over and that we could all get our men back, you know, they could get their sons and husbands back and carry on with their lives, because you heard a lot of that. Well, Joe's coming home, or Jimmy's coming home, or whatever the boy's name would be, and you could just see the eyes shining in the parents. So I lost a couple friends like Jerry. Never did know what happened to him. They just never came back. But that's something I don't like to dwell on.
My name is Florine Johnson Smith. My brother Ivan, we always called him Bud, was in the Army, in the 3rd Armored Division. He left in about 1940 or 41, and then my next brother Dale, and he left in about 1942, right after high school. And then I was the next one, and we were sort of close together more. Well, they were very different. My older brother was more of an outgoing type person, and sort of a bigger person. And my brother Dale was a very quiet, more of a home type person. His senior year, he got very sick with rheumatic fever, and he was in bed for a long time, and it affected his legs. But they still took him in the service, and it was on Thanksgiving Day that they said he was missing in action, and I said it was about 6 months later they declared him dead. So he was a traumatic time, when someone's missing in action, you always think, well, every day you're going to hear that they find them.
Swing low,
swing.
Family members weren't the only ones who felt the absence of those killed in battle. Men and women who made it home often carried memories of friends who died alongside them. For a few, those memories are haunting. Veteran Paul Schettenhelm served in the Pacific on the bridge of a troop transport ship.
It's awfully hard to get things like that off your mind, especially when you see kids brought back in the battlefield. We were a lot of them, they came on our ship, we took care of them, with no arms and things like that. And I was, say, 28 years old, and it sticks with your memory. I had to, you get the fidgets, and you, at nighttime you don't sleep very well. It takes a long time to kind of forget. You never do forget, really.
Veterans Administration hospitals, such as the one in Danville, Illinois, took in men debilitated by the emotional or psychological trauma of war. Some veterans, like Paul Schettenhelm, were treated and released within weeks or months. Others remained hospitalized for years. Lucille Froman served as a nurse on a hospital train in Europe during World War II. When she came home from her tour, she worked for 30 years as a nurse at the VA hospital in Danville. She worked with patients in the electric shock ward.
It was distressing because we used electric shock on about 40 or 50 patients about 3 days a week. And the nurse who was in charge wanted me to work with these people because I had been in service with not them per se, but with my peer, so to speak. One young man had His hands were blown off by a landmine, and he was blind, and he was very difficult to take care of. He hated himself, and he hated everybody, so we had to be very careful. He had had the prosthesis, the claws or whatever they gave him, and he would attack people with this, so he was really out of it. And he would say when he was at himself, "I wish I had died." You know, he was probably the most difficult, as I recall.
When I came to, I was on a cruiser. My hands were off. After that, I had it easy.
Easy?
That's what I said. They took care of me fine. They trained me to use these things. I can dial telephones. I can drive a car. I can even put nickels in a jukebox. I'm all right.
My husband was an example. He drank quite a bit, but he had been in the Navy, and he had one or two ships, as he explained it, shot out from under him. He ended up in the North Atlantic waters in the fire burning all around him, and it was pretty traumatic. Two times he found himself out in that cold, cold water, which was kind of scary. And he would have nightmares about it. So after Kennedy came into being our president, he decided we had too many, not we as such, had many of the guys locked up that did not need to be. So you see many of the VA patients walking the streets, and I'm not sure it's good or bad. They're able to maintain themselves, but it seems like they're so lonesome walking the streets. You know, we see them in Danville, and some of them I know, and some of them I don't even remember seeing, but they're able to maintain, but that's about it.
While some veterans struggled with mental trauma, most put their difficult war memories behind them. They came home to their families often as soon as they were discharged and took up where they left off before the war. Some had wives and children that they hadn't seen in several years. Many others got married and started families of their own. Soldiers and families had to get used to being around each other again.
Professor B.F. Timmons of the Department of Sociology will present a series of five discussions dealing with the adjustment of personal relations of the post-war family on the Homemaker's Quarter Hour at 1:01 p.m. every Wednesday in May. Dr. Timmons, well known to WILL listeners because of his many broadcasts from the classroom and from the studio on sociological problems, will be a special guest on the Homemaker's Quarter Hour, conducted daily, Monday through Friday, by Jesse Heathman. From the WILL Program Guide, May 1945.
Women going to work in the factories was one adjustment that families made. Factories in Illinois filled with women of all ages during the war, cranking out machine tools, engines, gloves, and bomb parts, anything the war demanded. Many women who never worked in factories before did so in the war years out of patriotism or to get by. Many of those who had worked before the war worked even harder, putting in extra shifts. Factories across the state took up a three-shift system, operating from the morning until late in the evening to boost production. The question that arose when men came home was, who works now?
When the war was over, my husband said, then you give your job to somebody that needs it with a family, a man that might be coming back. So that's what I did. I quit.
Nancy Hull worked at the Food Machinery Corporation plant in Hoopston. In addition to farm machinery, the plant made hoists to lift bombs into airplanes and hydraulic transmissions for submarines.
I was running a little mill, and we were doing a lot of war things for the airplanes and just little odd jobs, like, you know, what they had. And also there was a radio drill that was just right back of me that I helped on that some. And it was just more mechanical stuff that we did. Like the little mill was shaving down the little square things that goes in the, oh, like the, I suppose, bombs and things like that. Women put themselves in a man's place, and I myself know that we can't do what the men do. There's a lot of lifting of the heavy tools and things. A woman can't do that. And like where we're grinding tools, that was a man's job. That was more like a precision job. And I know I couldn't stand at the grinder without taking a couple fingers off.
part of the benefit of the winning the war is that women could, in fact, return to their homes.
Steve Rossworm is an American history professor at Lake Forest College.
Part of the reason that women, I think, were willing to leave the factories, the one who wanted to leave the factories, is that life during the war, there had been a great deal of advantages to being able to have a high-paying factory job, but there were also a lot of downsides as well, tremendous amount of stress, increased responsibility if their spouses were overseas fighting, of having to take care of a home and doing waged and unwaged work. And in a way, I think what many of these women were interested in was being able to take care of their families full time. I think that's what they wanted. That's what the war was about. By 1950, women's participation in the labor force is back to where it was at the height of the war in 44 or 45, except they're working in different kinds of jobs. They don't have high-paid factory jobs. What they have are what are called pink-collar jobs. That is, they're doing jobs that they're paid very little for.
My name's Lorraine Macbeth, and I've lived in Hoopston all my life. And I went to work in 1943, in the summer of 1943, at American Can, worked the summer there. I worked full-time for about 2 years, and then we got laid off because the men were coming back, and they took our jobs. I wasn't upset, but I would like to have gone on and worked at the American Can, and because we were getting good money. When we started American Can, we started 45 cents an hour, and hey, we were taking home $24, $25 a week. And like I say, back then, just getting out of school, that was good money. But no, I wasn't too upset because I wanted to better myself a little bit, so I got an office job, and I was very happy.
The war forced the country to increase its industrial production. The Defense Department provided money to build new factories and update existing ones. Some plants, which had never produced for the military before, retooled to supply everything from airplanes to combat boots. One Illinois company that answered the call was Sam Schmickler's Illinois Glove Company. His son, Gilbert Schmickler, remembers how his father expanded the company to fill the military demand.
The employment in Effingham and Champaign plants increased. The plant at Pena, Illinois, and its satellite at Nokomis were opened specifically on request of the Navy Department to manufacture what was called an anti-flash glove, which they still use. It's for men that are on the gun crews on the big ships to protect their hands and arms from flash burns as these large guns are fired. The other plants produced at Champaign, or some officers' dress gloves were produced, cold weather mittens for the Alaska, several different types of welder's gloves, lineman's gloves for stringing communications lines, which were used by the Signal Corps all over the world, and then gloves for general warmth that were required by each soldier.
But the end of the war would bring as many changes for the Illinois Glove Company as its beginning.
And I remember asking my father if he thought that the war was really over, because we knew that the bomb had gone off and there were all kinds of stories floating around. And he handed me a fistful of telegrams to read, each one advising the company that contract number such and such had been terminated. And after I looked through them, he says, "Well, now what do you think?" I said, "I guess it really is over." Dad turned over 90% of his production to the military, and that meant that he could not take care of his civilian customers. And over the years of the war, his most valued customers were taken over by competitors. When I entered the business, I posed the question to him that had he known what the result would be, on the loss of his civilian business to people who were avoiding doing military work, what would he have done? He said the same thing. He wouldn't have changed anything.
The company closed its plants in Pena and Nokomis right after the war and shut down its Champaign plant at the corner of Neal and Green Streets in 1957. but the company rebounded. Today, it makes civilian gloves in plants overseas. The only gloves it makes in America are for the military.
As a matter of fact, if you remember a month or two ago, the story about Captain O'Grady being shot down in over former Yugoslavia, and he was telling how he concealed himself in the bushes by putting his face down into the dirt and covering his ears and his head with his green gloves. Well, those were products of Illinois Glove Company.
While factory management made changes for peacetime, so did workers and soldiers returning from war. Before serving in the Pacific, Charles Cassad worked for the Illinois Central Railroad loading the mail. But when he got back, a demanding boss put him on the night shift.
After 2 years of taking orders from lieutenants and everything like that in the Navy, I just wasn't ready to take that kind of orders in civilian life.
Some returning soldiers had a hard time finding a job. Black soldiers who served in segregated units in the military found very few opportunities. Andrew Webb made steady money as a drill instructor, but returned to civilian life at the urging of his family.
It was a bad mistake, I think, because the job situation here in Illinois, especially for the blacks, was pretty rough. And they didn't live up to some of the promises that was made. It was a tradition. Everybody was happy during the war. It was my country, 'tis of thee. The flag was flying and all of that. But after you got back from the war, that Americanism was just about gone.
Some companies suffered from labor difficulties and materials shortages during the period after the war. Skilled workers who left to join the military had to be retrained, and machine tools used mercilessly to speed production had to be replaced. But by 1950, industrial production returned to its wartime levels. Illinois remained the third largest manufacturing state in the nation, with most manufacturing gains in the Chicago area. Heavy industries like iron and steel grew faster than food and clothing businesses, and the state became the center of the diesel engine industry. Companies like Food Machinery Corporation returned to producing equipment exclusively to meet consumer needs. Today, Food Machinery Corporation is known as FMC. Its Hoopston plant no longer makes bomb hoists, but now concentrates on huge harvesters for peas and cucumbers. The six-wheel red pea harvester's threshing system is designed to harvest the pods, open them, and dump the peas into a hopper. The price tag is $325,000. But in 1945, farm machinery was not so sophisticated.
My name is John Edwards. I live on South Ray Street Road, about 5 miles south of Urbana, and lived at this house all my life and farmed for 21 years.
Edwards' son runs the farm now and still occasionally uses one of the tractors his father bought in the years following the war. Edwards says his son still grows seed corn, but with a lot less help.
See this row? This row? That's what we call the pollinator row. And these have been detasseled. That's the same way we made seed corn in those days, but had to all be done by hand. And you can see this was cut off with a machine. That's the machine over there that has the cutters on it that you can drive down and get rid of it. You'd have to go over it with kids 4 or 5 times. They didn't get them all at once like a machine can. So we'd have to go back over it every couple of days. Let's get out of here. It's hot.
Immediately after the war, all hands were turned to readjustment.
Bob Spitzy is a University of Illinois agricultural economist.
This meant for Illinois agriculture they had to crank up again after the war effort, re-employ the men and women coming back from the service and from the factories, and begin producing for a bulging world demand, which was due to the destruction around the world. We had to help feed the world, as well as now a much more prosperous American population.
Farmers could now afford new technologies, Better tractors, agrochemicals, and seed hybrids became available, and these dramatically increased farmers' yields while reducing their labor needs. Farmers now had the ability to produce more food than the marketplace could bear.
After World War II, there was a period of intense discussion and decision-making about agricultural policy, and the thought was, if farmers went all out to produce for the war effort, and then, indeed, after the war, during the 50s and 60s, the supply rather consistently was more excessive than demand, therefore there were surpluses, and therefore there were price and income difficulties for farmers. There was a feeling that if farmers had contributed to the war, then they ought to get some sort of safety net after the war to protect them. And as we go through the 1995 agriculture and food policy making, which is top news now, it's interesting that the roots of some of these decisions that we're having to confront now, to what extent do farmers deserve and ought they have some kind of safety net, are the roots back there in World War II.
For many servicemen, returning to civilian life did not mean a return to a factory or the farm. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, better known as the GI Bill, granted a paid college education to every qualified veteran. Young veterans flooded Illinois campuses. By 1950, one of every four Illinois college students was a World War II veteran.
Well, my name is John Cribbett, and during the war years from 1941 to 1945, I was in the U.S. Army. I then came back shortly after the end of the war in Europe, and I got out rather quickly and came back to continue my legal education at Illinois.
Cribbett earned his law degree in 1947 and practiced law in Bloomington before returning to teach law at the U of I.
And when we came back, then there wasn't any place to live in Champaign-Urbana. There had been no building going on during the war. The university didn't have any facilities, weren't even many facilities for students, university facilities at that point. And so it was one thing to accept an appointment. It was another thing to have some place to live. But the university then built what were known as the parade ground units, and they were all built out near the stadium. And most of those were families, and they'd made barracks into little individual apartments. It was sort of an eerie feeling. I'd spent 4.5 years in military barracks, got back in civilian life, and here I was back in the barracks again. And it was a fairly productive period in one sense. There were a lot of children born as a result of that experience, so that many people referred to the whole thing as Fertile Acres. Although these barracks were, well, Spartan is the term for them. I used to laugh. I had a next-door neighbor who became a very good friend who always played his radio very loudly in the morning. He got up early, and he started, they'd play the national anthem about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd have to jump out of bed and salute practically because the partitions were so thin. But again, nearly everybody there was a veteran.
Today, the university is building new volleyball courts and sports fields where the parade ground units once stood. 50 years ago, the influx of new students changed the atmosphere on college campuses. Florine Smith was a student at the U of I during the war and worked at the bookstore for several years afterwards.
There's a lot of older people that came back, you know, and they had a very different attitude about school. Of course, they were kind of lively, and they were at the drinking age, you know, and the rest of them weren't. And a lot of them were really serious about going back to school and getting that thing, and I always thought that was nice that the government gave them that opportunity. And it was hard for them, you know, to go to school, and because a lot of them had families, and they were just being reunited, too, and it was sort of a, I would say, kind of a wild time for some of the servicemen to readjust.
Paul Schedenhelm had to adjust to being in school while supporting a family of four.
All they paid for was my books and my tuition. And I was getting $90 a month, which was 50% disability. 90 bucks a month. That was what they paid me. And that's all the money I had. And I kept going further in a hole. And I had two jobs I was working at, trying to make ends meet. Very difficult, really, with kids and trying to go to school. So I didn't get my degree because I wasn't interested in that. I'm ready to get out in the world, you know, not to get a degree, but to get the knowledge that I wanted to help me.
Many students did get their college degree using the GI Bill, increasing the nation's pool of educated workers. Cribbett calls it one of the wisest investments the federal government ever made.
Remember, there were millions of men coming back. And what are you going to do with all of them? At least until the economy gets going. The war industries are shutting down. The war has been won. And the worst thing that could possibly have happened would have been had millions of unemployed veterans coming back. So that if you look at it just purely in a very pragmatic sense, the GI Bill got people off the street and getting an education. Now, the more idealistic and perhaps the more important aspect was that people who had never thought of going to college now realized suddenly they could afford to go. So that we, for the first time, going on to college came to be much more the ordinary instead of the extraordinary thing to do.
It's not a big house, but it's comfortable for us. This is the room that we built on, had built on. And this is a bathroom and a closet back in there.
Home ownership and also became more ordinary as a result of the GI Bill. Mildred and Kenneth Harper bought the first house in Champaign County purchased under the GI Loan Program. It offered 30-year fixed-rate mortgage financing with no money down.
It was a front porch, and there was a petition right there. And we had a porch swing out there all during those years that he was gone. And
the August 10, 1945 edition of the Urbana Evening Courier describes the Harpers' home and shows two photos. One is of the couple and their daughter in the kitchen, holding tomatoes from their victory garden. The other shows them sitting on lawn chairs in front of a small four-room house.
Well, that was years, long time ago. Let's see, 50 years ago. Yeah, I had all the awnings made and put on. I'd done an awful lot of work on it.
The programs established by the GI Bill continue today. More than 14 million veterans have purchased homes under the loan guarantee. The government provides veterans money for college, but with more restrictions and fewer choices. Still, qualified Illinois servicemen can get a free education at their state universities.
Gentlemen, the President of the United States.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans.
Thank God for the atomic bomb. Because I don't think we'd have... I'd be here sitting talking to you if it wasn't for that.
I think it was just too much power, even though we won the war from that. I don't think that that's something that should have never been invented.
It was something that just had to be done. Everybody's complaining about our dropping the atomic bomb, but you never hear anybody complaining about all the dust that Hitler caused over in Germany and that. Nobody thought anything of that. But now suddenly it seems to be stylish to pick on the United States. Well, I'm a firm believer in this. This is my country.
We had a lady call me up and said, I don't know what to do, whether to hide, but says they've turned that their bomb loose and says that'll kill us all. I said, oh, no, 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 it won't. I said, just go back to you doing whatever you're doing and forget it. I said, you probably never know what's happened. And we didn't.
Robert Oppenheimer and the team that designed and built the bomb witnessed the first atomic explosion.
I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
We thought it was great. Now, a lot of people, I think, are changing their minds, and a lot of people that didn't live right through it don't look at it that way. But at that time, it was a great thing. I think people were ready to just wipe them completely off the earth.
I don't believe in killing women and children. They're innocent. They didn't do you any harm at all. I argue about that every day of the week. You know, you don't like killing at all, but those are soldiers we killed. Wasn't the people had anything to do with it. It's just like in this country. Someday, I'm going to hope it don't come backlash on us and come back at us. And I still disagree with them about dropping the atom bomb 100%.
We knew that we had killed just as many people by firebombing Tokyo and by other things as were killed by the atomic bomb. To the people who die, it doesn't make much difference which way you die. There isn't any very good way.
Dr. Roger Adams, head of the Department of Chemistry here at the University of Illinois, and one of the leading chemists of the world, has just returned to the campus from a 40-day trip to Japan. He went as chairman of a special scientific group from the National Academy of Sciences to study science and scientific organizations in Japan. We just had an interesting visit with Dr. Adams here in his office, and we're going to ask him some questions that have occurred to us during the conversation. I believe you visited one of the cities on which an atomic bomb was dropped. Is the damage still apparent, and what do the people think of that bombing?
The people in Hiroshima, where we visited for a day, had a curious psychology. They believed that because they accepted the first atomic bomb, even though there were 150,000 people killed, that they did much toward establishing peace in the world. And therefore, on the second anniversary of the dropping of the bomb, when we happened to be there, there was a peace celebration going on and a holiday for all the citizens in the city.
Well, did you see any people who had been victims of the atomic bombing, and how do they get along? I mean, do they get along all right with other people and everything work out all right?
So far as we could see, they got along perfectly well and didn't hold any resentment.
They don't hold any resentment against the American people over there?
None of the people whom we saw held any resentment.
My chief purpose was to end the war in victory, with the least possible loss of American lives. I never had any qualms about using an instrument that finally ended the war, in which we'd have had 250 or 300,000 of our youngsters killed and 700,000 of them maimed. Napoleon made the statement, the Lord was always on the side of the heaviest artillery. I had to make the decision as to whether the atom bomb was just another piece of artillery.
This is a story of atom and evil. Their courtship is causing a great upheaval. Now Adam was a sweet, young, innocent thing until the night that Miss Evil took him under her wing. Now Adam was an honest, hard-working man. He wanted to help out the human clan. But Miss Evil got him drunk on prejudice and hate, and she taught him how to gamble with humanity's fate.
So true.
I'm talking about Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve. If you don't break up that romance, soon
we'll all fall down and go boom, boom, boom.
Now if evil gets Adam, 'twill be such a shame, because plenty of big shots are playing that dame. Lord, his sleep will be trouble, and his life will be cursed. Now, if Adam sleeps with evil Jack, he won't be the first.
So true.
I'm talking about Adam and evil. Adam and evil. If you don't break up that romance,
I'll fall down and go boom, 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 boom.
At the historic instant when the first atomic bomb seemed to charge out of the bowels of the earth, Professor George Kistakovsky remarked, "I am sure that on doomsday, in the last millisecond, the last man on earth will see what we have just seen." In direct contrast, William Lawrence of the New York Times felt as though he were present at the dawn of creation when the Lord said, "Let there be light." If the universe is as many millions of years old as we think it is, our crowded little era is but an instant of yesterday when it is past. 1933's unemployment, September at Munich, that June 10th at Liturgy, December 7th at Pearl Harbor, 9:15 over Hiroshima, were all part of the identical moment. The one question remaining then, was it 23:59 o'clock or 0001? Was there to be still another cycle of affliction, appeasement, and annihilation? Or had we walked through midnight towards the dawn without knowing it?
I don't think anybody knows how the war is unless you're there. My kids, sometimes they will ask something, but they don't seem to be, not that it matters, they don't seem to be terribly interested. My grandson had some, I had a class, and he needed some information about World War II, and I had a book here that I gave to him, and I told him a little bit, but they don't teach it in the schools very much. He seemed to be interested at the time. He needed to know some information for school, but I don't know. You know, it's good, I think, that people forget. Unless you're there and part of it, and I was only a small part of it, I don't think you can know. You don't have any way to know. How do you tell somebody what happened? Especially some people really don't care. You know, I'd rather not hear it. And that's okay. That's okay.
People, they say that they wouldn't go back to them days. I would. People were a lot happier. It was a slower pace. You didn't have TV. You listened to radio. You had more time for entertainment. People come over and you'd sit around and talk about things, or you'd go to a movie. But nowadays, people sit in front of the TV, and it's just a regular rat race. 9 out of 10 people don't even know their own neighbor. Back in them days, you used to have a 4-foot fence, the highest. You could talk over the fence about the troubles of the day or about your family, how your garden was doing. Nowadays, they come up with these 6-foot fences and you don't even know your neighbor.
The war, World War II, for my generation, was the great divide. I mean, everything was sort of pre-war and post-war. And this is the way it was before the war, this is the way it is after the war. Not so much had changed during the war, that is, certainly not in the physical sense, because there was no money going into civilian housing or building anything. But attitudes had changed tremendously. And everything looked different somehow. You know, I had seen the devastation in Europe. I was with one of the units, was the first ones to uncover one of the concentration camps, saw the horrors that were wreaked in the Holocaust, had seen German cities and English cities virtually obliterated, Coventry and so forth. You come back to the Midwest, it's kind of like a different world. You've moved out of a world of destruction and chaos into a world of order and sanity. And it looked, you know, it looked the same in a physical sense as it had before we left, but you never looked at it in quite the same way.
This hour you heard the voices of Ruby Simpson, Bernhard Rosenquist, Charles Green, Paul Schoedenhelm, Charles Cassad, Florian Smith, Lucille Frohman, Celeste Quinn, Nancy Hull, Steve Rossworm, Lorraine Macbeth, Gilbert Schmickler, Andrew Webb, John Edwards, Bob Spitzy, John Cribbett, Mildred Harper, Kenneth Harper, Jerry Fleck, Thelma Wilson, Helen Bricker, and Roger Adams. Archival material came from the International News Service, the American Broadcasting Company. The film The Best Years of Our Lives, copyright 1946 by Samuel Goldwyn Productions. The Truman Tapes, copyright 1977 by Cademan. The World at War, copyright 1982 by Thames Television. And I Can Hear It Now, copyright by Columbia Masterworks. Peace Comes to the Prairie was produced by Peter Clowney and Brent Wolfe. Production assistance from Jack Brighton, Vincent Duffy, Rob Schober, and Jake Schumacher. Thanks also to Alex Ashlock, Jason Croft, Joan Harshbarger, and Ed West. We had help from Charlie Tice in the Early American Museum in Mahomet, Greg Klein, J. Philip Bloomer, and the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette, the University of Illinois Archives, the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, the Champaign County Historical Archives, John Kramer, Louis Green, and Louis Watts Hout. Thanks also to Sandra Batsley, Clarence Beerbaum, Warren Bergman, Maynard Bridgeford, Bill Cooper, Glenn Davis, Mildred Edwards, Marvin Geiken, Juanita Geiken, Dorothy Gilbert, Harold Geither, W.C. Hampton, Ramona Henricks, Lorenzo Johnson, Stephen Kish, Vera Kish, Marion Kyle, Clay Lofton, Dale Macbeth, Shirley Peters, Jim Stallmeyer, and Frank Warengo. Peace Comes to the Prairie is an AM 580 production. I'm Dan Simeone.
As the crowd files out from the quadrangle at the University of Illinois, and the V-12s now follow the ASTRs away from the bandstand in front of the steps of the auditorium, our program comes to a close. Today's music by the concert band of the orchestra was under the direction of Mr. A.A. Harding and Clarence Sawhill. This is the University of Illinois Radio Service, WILL in Urbana-Champaign.